Flight of the Conchords is now on Stitcher Premium. Hear all 6 episodes of the original BBC radio series that inspired their hit HBO show. This Laugh Out Loud series is available exclusively on Stitcher Premium in the U.S. Start listening now with a 1-month free trial of Stitcher Premium. Go to stitcherpremium.com/BBC and use promo code CRACKED at checkout to get your free month. That's stitcherpremium.com/BBC and use promo code CRACKED. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Crack Movie Club, the show where we dissect recent films within like the past couple of decades and really work to make you, the listener, an expert in whatever film we happen to be talking about. Today is the first episode of our new director. It's Christopher Nolan month.
Woo!
This month.
Yeah.
And we're going to be talking about the 2006 film The Prestige.
Nice.
With our guest, the very funny comedian Jamie Loftus.
Hi.
He's also the co-host of the Bechdel cast.
Sure am.
And awesome. As always, I'm Abe Epperson.
And I'm Tom Ryman.
So we'd like to ask you, Jamie, mm-hmm. when was the first time you ever saw this movie?
Yesterday.
Sweet.
Awesome. Fresh blood.
Yes.
What was your just initial impression of the film?
It's funny, I felt targeted by you guys, because I hate magicians.
Which we did our study before.
Do they not know I've had my heart broken by multiple magicians?
No way.
Oh, I have a severe magician prejudice. I've been gaslighted by magicians like you wouldn't believe.
And this movie is about a magician gaslighting his wife.
Yeah.
I know.
Among other things.
Hold on, I have a few questions. where do you hang out? do you find magicians?
Well, magicians magicians sort of sometimes want to be comedians, and so they're like, I could be funny. I'm a magician. Mm-hmm. Or there's like some magicians who are like, I'm going to do an open mic, and then mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. where I meet them. That's where I fall in love with them.
Because with the sleight of hand and everything, it's pretty sexy.
God. Obviously, they must have a very dazzling act.
No, they're garbage. Oh. They're just
sorry, magicians out there, or amateur magicians.
Honestly, I would kick any magician's ass.
All right.
Yeah.
I feel like at this point, it's kind of your fault and not ours.
Listen.
That this keeps happening.
The thing, but the other thing is with this movie is I know, because I have dated magicians, I know a lot about magic, and I had a pretty solid baseline education to be like, oh yeah, Victorian era magic. I do. I mean, I like to hate things in a very informed way, and I know a lot about. There's a lot of like old school magic refs in this movie.
Oh word, yeah. I knew there were some, but we'll be
there's
interested
some fun ones, and then some like really stupid ones, like the fact that the two main characters' initials spell out Abra.
Yeah. Abra,
sure.
Yeah.
Grow up. There. But anyways, I hate magicians. I regret to inform you that I enjoyed this movie.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, good. I did too.
Yeah, we all did. So if you haven't seen the movie, go in and watch a plot summary right now, because we're going to spoil the shit out of this.
I watched it twice in one night, too.
Oh. Jamie, why don't you favor us with a brief...
Yeah, brief.
A brief plot description. Like.
Yeah, give us that.
Okay, so it's about these two magicians already... Hang in there. It gets two magicians, Hugh Jackman and Christian Bale. What are their names?
Borden.
Abra.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about these two magicians. Originally, they're working with Hugh Jackman's wife, Piper Perabo, who dies at the beginning of the movie, because that's how Christopher Nolan forwards the plot, by killing a woman. Mm-hmm. So that's how it starts. Is Christian Bale is arguably like responsible sort of for the death of Hugh Jackman's wife. They start out this rivalry. Michael Caine provides exposition throughout the film, but it's basically this very extended rivalry that goes on for years, where they're trying to outdo each other with tricks and just a good old boy fight. And Nikola Tesla shows up.
Drops in.
He's David Bowie, and he's the best magician out of everybody. And
real magic.
Right. Oh, yeah. As Michael Caine says, like, it's real magic.
It's real.
It's science.
It's the most disappointing of all. There is no trick.
That is, oh, my God. How
real,
many of Michael Caine's lines can you just predict 40 minutes before he says them? He's like, this is real magic, you know. So Michael Caine is there to just give a soliloquy every once in a while to just, you know, break the pace. Christian Bale's wife kills herself because it's a Christopher Nolan movie.
Sure.
And it's the second act, so time for another woman to die. Scarlett Johansson's in it. She's a femme fatale. Whose side is she on? We don't know. And the plot ends up not really telling us. And then she's sort of kicked out by
but
the end.
But at least she escapes with her life.
At least she survives. She is, you know, she's the hottest, so she does live. And then at the end, can we do the big reveal?
Yeah,
sure. Yeah, we're going to be talking about it. So
at the end, they're stealing each other's. I keep wanting to say jokes because they remind me of shitty open micers.
You're right.
They're stealing each other's goofs. They've killed people. They're still like, mad. This is where it's worth it because magic. And at the end, there's this big trick. This big goof that Hugh Jackman is doing.
The teleporting man.
Mm-hmm. Where he steals David Bowie, Nikola Tesla's trick and clones himself and repeatedly kills his clones for reasons I'm not entirely sure of. But he's like killing all his clones every night for the trick. Maybe so the clones can't tell anyone
that's
about
it. That's absolutely
right. We'll get into it.
Yeah.
there's some theories.
Yeah, I was like, that was a weird one. But so Hugh Jackman frames Christian Bale for his murder because Christian Bale is there when one of the clones dies. Then Hugh Jackman tries to take custody of Christian Bale's daughter in disguise, in one of his many goateed disguises. And that's like fucked up and weird. And at least everyone else seems to think so too.
Right.
Michael Caine's like, yeah. Well, you do it.
I can't do this. You can't take this man's daughter from him.
This is not real magic.
That's not real magic.
That's just dirty tricks. I love that is the point where Michael Caine's like, I'm tapping out.
Right, that's the point where he's like, I can't do it.
Nikola Tesla's a magician? Okay, but. And then at the end we find out Christian Bale was twins the whole time.
Oh, yes.
He's got this partner named Fallon, who is just Christian Bale with jowls and a beard. And
little baby cheeks.
Yeah, the real Christian Bale lives. Hugh Jackman is shot and dies, and then he says, like, you know, his last words are like, you should have seen the audience's faces. And I'm like, oh, that's why this whole movie happened. Right. And then Christian Bale gets his daughter back and Michael Caine does what he does at the end of every movie, which is exchange a knowing nod with Christian Bale.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's true.
That's the movie.
That's a good sum up.
Solid sum up, yeah.
On this show, we like to compare your plot description to a few of our own rudimentary summaries. Feel free to join us in on a segment we like to call Terrible Loglines.
Yeah.
Take us away, Tom.
A magician hates his brother's wife to death.
It's true. She really is fine, except for one of the brothers.
Yeah, right.
I got one. Bird murder device invented for the delight of children.
Dazzles them, really.
Dazzles them, really.
Christian Bale gives his voice a break between Batman movies.
He does.
That's true.
Two grown men engage in a decades-long false beard war.
That's true.
So much money on fake beards.
What was the beard budget?
Beard budget, just astronomical.
The beard and bird budget for this film.
Two brothers perform the most intense pinky swear.
One-dimensional characters give two-dimensional male characters three dimensions over the period of 120 minutes.
It adds up.
We got one dimensional.
Two assholes prank murder each other with magic.
Yep. This one I'm not going to claim ownership of. This one was given to our lead engineer, Brett. Nikola Tesla invents actual magic. No one cares.
You sort of forget about that.
Here's one. Two open micers discover that the key to comedy was Fallon the whole time.
The key to comedy.
I want to see the comedy version of this. Like, I want to see not the comedy, but like the comedian version of this. I want to see two comedians.
It is so easily adaptable to like garbage open micers being like, hey, I'm over here and you're across the street and I have a joke about Tinder and you have a joke about Tinder, but we're doing the same joke. And everyone's like, you know.
Yeah.
But this is Victorian times and people don't have anything to do, so they actually go.
Right. Yeah.
The only difference
get up
is people give a fuck
with their fans, and then they walk across the street.
The only thing I was missing was like the lip sync battle. You know what I mean? Right.
Where
that's
was the
real
celebrity
comedy
prank?
I know. God, he's so funny.
He's Fallon. Such a... Listen, my, shout out to Jimmy Fallon. You're a fucking comedy god, yeah. And we all respect you.
Jesus. Because he listens to our show. He's so. a fan of the show.
He's gonna. I'm going to tweet this at him until he listens to it.
Poor Fallon.
Sweet.
So now you know the plot. Let's dive into the making of the movie from like a pre-production standpoint.
We can call it that from now on.
To a post-per.
Pre-pro?
A post-production. In a segment we like to call Expensive Pretending.
Yes.
So.
Expensive Pretending.
Let's talk about some scripting.
Oh, yeah. So.
Script crap.
I'm
ready.
This is based on a 1995 book by a British author named Christopher Priest. And the book is a little more horror-based because a big connection with magicians back at this time was spiritualism, you know, like spirit photography, seances, and stuff like
that. Yeah, the occult or Rosicrucian kind
right, of. Yeah. And magicians would often adopt that into their personas because it's an easy way to make money. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Harry Houdini famously was debunking all that stuff.
Right.
So the spiritual element comes into play basically in the end of the story, like Hugh Jackman's character becomes a ghost and just kind of like lives on forever. Like that's like the main difference between two stories. But
a spiritual aspect.
Right. There's a spiritual aspect that was taken out, but the sci-fi horror elements were kept when the book was adapted by Nolan and his brother, Jonathan.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was reading in the book, I guess you find out the twins reveal is like way sooner.
Right.
It's not like the
really?
The last minute. Yeah.
Well, I don't know much about that. Like I read a brief summary.
Well, if you
I
got like, ghosts in your act three, I feel like that kind of
right.
shifts, you know,
yeah.
twins
right.
to
They're
act
like,
two.
Twins is act two, and then we get into the whole Hugh Jackman ghost
thing. Yeah.
By the way, he's a fucking ghost.
Yeah. You're like, oh, tight, cool. It's fun to watch interviews with Christopher Priest because all he does is talk about what a big old crush he had on Christopher Nolan.
Yeah,
oh,
he's
man,
like delighted.
They loved it.
He's like, I'm such. I love Memento so much, and it's like he just. Oh,
well, that's what got him
tickled.
Yeah,
Memento got him the job.
That's what got him the job because this was gonna. Sam Mendes wanted to do this. This was gonna mm-hmm. be his follow up to American Beauty,
mm-hmm.
and they were like in negotiations and like ready to close. And then Priest got an offer from whoever was representing Nolan at the time, maybe Newmarket.
I don't know.
I think so.
But it wasn't Memento. It was actually Following.
Yeah, he saw Following.
Which was his first film.
Yeah. And he was like, oh, this is pretty good. And then he kind of wanted to give the book to like an unknown director because Nolan was a nobody.
Yeah, he's a nobody. And I thought I was just reading this last night because I was doing research on this. And I thought it was really funny or just a silly thing that they included, which was the VHS tape of Following was sent to Sam Mendes. Via motorbike?
Sam Mendes or Priest?
Oh, I'm sorry.
To Priest.
To Priest.
Like a bike messenger?
A bike messenger because Nolan couldn't get away from his like post-workflow for Memento. Because at that time, it was going to release in 2000, obviously.
Man, he was still making Memento.
He was still making Memento during the whole negotiation process.
So he was like true nobody.
Yeah, so well, this is in like 1999, 2000, it took 6 years to even get there because of...
Christopher Priest had a real little crushy poo.
He
did.
Little
crushy poo. Yeah,
like how do you... It's like it's... Because Sam Mendes just won the Academy Award,
yeah.
and he's like, we want to make this... How do you like...
It's like, no, I want this little cutie pie.
No, I like this guy.
He's just like,
oh, he's adorbs.
Oh, he's...
This guy.
Let the cutie make my magic movie.
He writes with his brother.
Yeah.
He didn't, though. This was the first time.
Right.
Memento was a short story that his brother had written, and then Nolan wrote the screenplay by himself. This was the first, and I think only time, that they actually both worked on the screenplay together at the same time.
Right. It was a co-write.
Good for Jonathan.
Yeah, good for old Jonathan.
Good old
so
Johnny.
I love when they throw Jonathan a bone. I went on like a serious Nolan binge last night. I watched The Prestige. I watched The Prestige again after I got home from the show I was doing. And then I watched Memento because I'd never seen it before. And then I watched a lot of featurettes on both.
Cool.
Anyways, I was up till like 5 a.m.
Just things you do for our podcast.
Man. Listen, I love homework.
Hardest core guest we've had. So
yeah,
I
think that
homework.
Elevates you to the top of the list of guests.
Definitely,
you did homework.
Homework.
I love it.
All star
cool
CMC.
Hell.
Guest.
I love it.
I love. But one of the other things I love about Jonathan Nolan is that he deliberately adopted an American accent. He went to He went to school Georgetown, I think.
Why is he sticking to that?
I don't know.
It's
like he,
so
I read something like he thought his English accent was like put him at a disadvantage for some reason. I don't know, because Nolan, Christopher Nolan, went to school in London, and like he's very British.
He's
and
then
like
super British,
his brother
yeah.
goes to school in America. He's like trying to be, no, I'm going to be American. So he like goes to college in America and he adopts an American accent. So when you hear him talk, it's like, this is his brother.
Right. I'm like, are they like cousins? What is this?
Is this like a Danny DeVito Schwarzenegger twins situation? Like,
it's weird because I was reading about how they wrote Memento like together but not together, where they like the way the interview with Christopher Nolan, I watched this like 18-minute interview with him, and he
is
was
is that
like,
the one with the chalkboard?
The chalkboard yep. interview, yeah, where he does like it's like a hairpin or whatever.
Oh, you sent me that link and then I didn't watch it because I'm a fool, but you guys watched
no,
it.
No, we're so going to talk about it on the Memento episode, I think.
But like basically he's like, yeah, my brother and I like sort of talked the story out, and then we're like, let's write this story separately. So it's weird because like Jonathan Nolan did write the short story, but it doesn't. I don't think that it plays out like Christopher Nolan's Memento.
So they went off and wrote two different,
versions of the same story talked about.
A novelization and a screenplay.
Kind of like Big Bro throwing Lil Bro a bone. Like, hey, he wrote it too. I love my brother. He's weird. He has a weird accent.
He's got a story credit on a lot of Nolan's films.
Priest loved the adaptation, though.
He did,
and
yeah.
As you said, he's this little cutie poo. He described it in Priest's words, an extraordinary and brilliant script, a fascinating adaptation of my novel, which is probably the only time I've ever heard a novelist ever say about maybe Kaufman talking about adaptation or Fight Club from Polanyi, but those are the only two times that I've ever heard like someone go like, this is like better than mine, you know, like this is a great adaptation.
And I saw
they usually hate it
with an interview with him and then also with Nolan. Like Nolan said, writing the script apparently took them 5 years off and on, because he said it was just the most difficult thing to write because the book is so apparently very, very literary, like in all of its references and themes and stuff. And a lot of that, it took them a lot of time to figure out how to adapt that into a visual, you know, element. And that was one of the things that Priest was specifically referenced in an interview. He was like, one of the things he was most impressed with, he was like, because all the stuff in the book is so literary, and he was able to still able to take the major themes and write it in a way that still worked in the context of a movie.
Right.
I wonder if they ever kissed on the mouth, because it seems like
open mouth kiss.
Yeah, just like Christopher Priest would be like, the adaptation was so freaking good. I'm such a fan. I'm so glad you're doing so well. I believed in you from the beginning. Please kiss me on the mouth. Seems like a reasonable argument for a mouth kiss.
Yeah, sure.
And Christopher Nolan seems like, man, you know, maybe an accommodating collaborator.
He might give his teeth an old polish with his tongue.
See,
polish the molars.
Slick them up.
Slick them up. Slick them up. Slick them down.
Slick them up, and then be like, "All right, here I come. Teeth first for a mouth kiss.
We're gonna bite each other's teeth."
I love that there's
the most
a lot of
romantic kiss.
A lot
can
of communication beforehand. Tongue in, tongue out.
Yeah.
Hands up.
Well, they worked on an adaptation of The Kiss, so he just exhausted.
There was a 5-year plan. Yeah. Emma Thompson is associate producing The Kiss. She's in the room, making sure everything's okay. Christopher Nolan's daughter is there, as she is in the movie.
They're like, that's a PG kiss. We need a PG-13.
He's like, yeah, this is how, you know, this is like the last part of our contract is we must kiss on the mouth.
It's just snuck in there in the end. And you must kiss on the mouth.
A little Hollywood asterisk in there.
Jonathan's just sitting there watching through a window.
Listen, when Madonna's "This Used to Be My Playground."
Yeah.
The true prestige.
Yeah. One day I'll be kisses.
Someday kisses for Jonathan.
I want to talk about casting. There's a lot of cool casting things about this movie.
I had read that Josh Hartnett was originally considered for Robert Angier,
which
instead
is
of Hugh Jackman.
I mean, you just can't get like the swagger of Hugh Jackman, how cool he is and how like kind of tortured he is. I mean, he's our Wolverine.
Yeah, I also it also strikes me that Josh Hartnett wouldn't have been old enough.
He has a baby face.
Right. He looks more like a and like he's in like his early 20s.
He was considered for Hugh Jackman's?
He was considered for Hugh Jackman's part. Yeah.
Interesting.
And it's not that he's a bad actor, because he's been in bad stuff, but if you watch like Lucky Number 11, there's like a few times that he's pulled off a like kind of haunting performance, so I guess that's why.
I feel like he's got a McConaughey in him.
Yeah, he does.
I think he is talented. Yeah, he
definitely
doesn't get
does.
Good stuff.
Right. But it's still the baby face I can't get past.
Right. Yeah.
You know, especially next to Christian Bale, who's like they're almost like equal masculinity, if that makes sense. They both have the square jaw. Yeah. They're both like fairly muscular men. They've both played superheroes.
Well, they have a commanding presence,
yeah,
which makes sense because they're both supposed to be stage performers, and I don't see that. Like
Josh
Hartnett
is
kind of like
live.
A slider guy.
Yeah, he's live.
When I think of Josh Hartnett, I'm like, shouldn't he be losing his virginity? Like,
right,
that's what,
or like wackily pursuing some lady. Like,
right, he should be tripping. He should be doing a little pratfall and being I'm
goofily
sorry.
Goofily dropping his groceries or something.
I love you so much. And then drops groceries.
I'm not going to have sex for 30 days and nights. Like the movie.
I thought something interesting was The Prestige is one of three 2006 films that feature both the topic of magic and magicians as main characters.
It was like the volcano Dante's Peak thing.
Yeah, it was Twinima, I believe is what they call it. But this one was Triplenima. I don't know.
Triplema.
But yeah. The other two are The Illusionist and Scoop.
Scoop?
I do not know Scoop.
Scoop is a lesser known film, but also stars Hugh Jackman and Scarlett Johansson.
Are they just magic heads?
They just were all into magic.
They need to grow up.
2006, the year of magic. But yeah, The Illusionist was Paul Giamatti and Edward Norton.
Jessica Biel.
Yeah, Jessica Biel.
I remember that one.
I haven't seen
it. Which is not bad.
It's okay.
Yeah. Prestige still wins.
It's a very different, it's like the opposite tone.
I almost wanted to watch Now You See Me. to be like a more contemporary magic film.
Michael Caine in it.
Michael Caine.
He loves magic. For sure, he frequents the Magic Castle. If I was brought to the Magic Castle, I would perform the ultimate trick, which is leaping from the top of the Magic Castle because I would not want to be there.
For everyone
Somebody
who doesn't
recently
know.
Recently killed himself there, so probably not. Not to make light of the man's death. But
there's a tonal shift right there.
There's some truth in that.
I'm going to pull a Christopher Nolan plot twist and be like, a woman ended her life in a magical place.
Right, yeah. And then you can be content in knowing that
you would propel
some magician's life story forward into
into act two.
If for everyone who doesn't know, in LA, there's a place called the Magic Castle, which is kind of like not a secret society, but it's kind of hard to get.
You have to get invited,
and magicians hold it's a whole show. It happens like weekly, right? I've never actually been.
Here's the horrible part: I have not even dated a good enough magician to
get
have
into
gone
the, magic,
to the
castle.
Magic Castle.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a cult kind of following thing in LA. One of those.
And there's an interesting. I've been hearing a lot of stuff recently about how there. I mean, there's no female magicians at the Magic Castle. It's supposed to be this like weird, kind of misogynist sausage fest behind the scenes there because it's all men. I mean, it's always like historically been all men, but it kind of still is, which is weird.
That I'd never thought about that until you just said that, but I can't think of a single female magician.
But I think honestly that's for the best, and the answer is to just rid the world of magicians entirely instead of getting women into the magic practicing field. But if it's gonna stick around.
I'll be honest, I can't think of male magicians. Penn and Teller's the only ones I can.
David Blaine.
Chris Angel.
The Mayan.
They're
getting
magicians.
His own star on the Walk of Fame.
Oh,
the
I forgot about Chris Angel.
Yeah.
I forgot about
a lot
of these guys.
That's not like,
I just don't care.
magic sucks. It's boring.
Well,
it can be fun for like children.
I am the mind freak. I used to love that show. He was like a goth magician.
He has like a Houdini streak in that he does a thing where he debunks quote unquote spiritualists, and that's like the only time.
Yeah,
that's watching Joe Rogan blast Carlos Mencia. It's like the only time you have respect for somebody that was like, oh, all right, Chris Angel.
That's why he's hot, because he's like, God's not real, but magic is, and you're just like, oh my God, I love this man. Like he's like Hot Topic magic.
Yes.
Which in high school, I just say, when I did bring up Chris Angel, I did shift in my seat because I think I still might have a crush on Chris Angel.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now that I'm
he represents something in your
man.
Life, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've lost where we are.
I'll bring us back. I was talking about how in 2006 there was
the other magic
Twinima. I also thought it was interesting.
This is going to be my favorite episode, I can tell.
I also thought it was interesting that the six main stars have played roles in comic book films. Christian Bale and Michael Caine were in Batman. Mm-hmm. Hugh Jackman was Wolverine.
He had already done three Wolverines.
Scarlett Johansson eventually went on to play Black Widow. Rebecca Hall appeared as Maya Hansen in Iron Man 3. Yeah. And Andy Serkis plays Ulysses Claw. Yeah, whatever. And Avengers Age of Ultron.
And in Black Panther.
Of course, David Bowie is also in the movie.
David Bowie is also in the movie.
He's also a superhero.
That's Christopher Nolan's little crushy that he gets away with because he's like the only person I wanted to play it was David Bowie. I was like, yeah, of course, everyone wants David Bowie to play everything, but this time Nolan, the little trickster, actually got away with it
because Bowie turned him down originally.
Yeah, at this point he hadn't acted in anything. Like, he was done with acting at this point. Right. I don't think he'd done anything in a decade, at least.
A long time. It took me a while to realize that it was David Bowie. I'm like, weird David Bowie. Like, I was like, David Bowie type was cast as Nikola Tesla?
Yeah.
Who's, like, someone I'm really interested in. And so it's weird that his plot line in this movie is very weird.
We'll get into that. I think it makes sense.
I like it, as but far it's
as
weird.
It's weird. It makes sense as far as the themes of the movie. Right. But we'll get to that. My favorite part of the Nolan casting is, you know, you mentioned Bowie turned him down. So he goes out to visit Bowie personally to, like, convince him to be in the movie. And the way he did it was by saying, look, you're the only person who can play Tesla because we have this crazy machine that he has to build, and nobody's going to believe it unless you're Tesla.
Yeah.
And David Bowie's like, all right.
Yeah. I'll give you 10 days.
That makes sense.
I am the only one who can pass his machines.
Right. Well, because we all knew he was from space.
Yeah.
Like, the only one who can do it is Ziggy Stardust. And it's like, all right.
So it doesn't bother us. Like, that's really weird. That guy doesn't seem magical. But David Bowie, it's like, yeah.
He's 10,000% magical.
That's Tesla.
Like, we mentioned David Bowie, I shifted in my seat.
I'm very glad that he ended up playing Nikola Tesla. But that was like, what a weird thing for Christopher Nolan to have stuck in his head. Like, it's gotta be Bowie. Like, that's
sometimes
so interesting.
Happens, yeah. They get an idea where it's like nobody else can play this. They just have it envisioned perfectly in their mind.
David Bowie is to Christopher Nolan as Christopher Nolan is to Christopher Priest.
Ooh.
Crush boys.
Another weird, like, casting artifact that I found was Andy Serkis's character. What's his name in there?
Allie.
When he's first introduced, he makes a reference to a magic trick, and he's like, can you guess the item in my pocket?
Yeah.
Which is the exact same trick that Serkis' character Gollum used in The Hobbit.
Ooh. In The Hobbit, yeah.
Yeah, I just thought that was weird. Like, The Hobbit came out in 2012.
Right.
But it's also in the book, right?
And they mention it in Lord of the Rings in the original trilogy.
Okay.
The original trilogy.
So
I'm not positive.
It's a knowing artifact then, for sure.
Possibly,
I didn't catch that.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those weird things I was like, that's...
And I think a watch is one of the things that Gollum guesses, right?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Or time is one of the...
One more neat thing I had, where I thought it was neat, is Hugh Jackman based his performance on a real magician named Channing Pollock. Who was frequently billed as the most beautiful man in the world.
It's a bold statement.
But Pollock. Like the guy, he's very visible. Like, you know, he was around in the mid 20th century. So he performed at the Ed Sullivan Show, and then he eventually gave up magic to become an actor. So his performance is based on this guy, like his mannerisms and like this guy, Channing Pollock, would like deliberately, he would only smile when he took his bow at the end. Like, the rest of the time he's very serious. And I'm pretty sure Hugh Jackman does that when he starts performing as Danton. Like,
that
he doesn't smile until the end. But I thought that was interesting. If you or a close family member take daily medications, pay close attention. Chances are you've gotten the chain drugstore runaround. Long lines, multiple trips, chasing doctors and insurance companies. You know, all those frustrations you get when you try to go to Rite Aid or whatever. So enter Fill, the smarter prescription refill service. Your monthly medications are filled by top-rated, locally owned pharmacies and delivered to your door for free. All you have to do is take a minute to sign up on their website. Your prescriptions arrive month after month to your door on time. If you run out of refills or there's a hiccup with your insurance, they troubleshoot everything so you don't have to. Your copays remain the same, you don't pay a dime in shipping, and they accept most insurance plans. And the best part is you would be supporting a locally owned pharmacy that prides itself in serving you. Go to fill.us/club and give them a try. That's fill, like the person, .us/club. They'll even take $20 off your first prescription refill. And if you're not 100% satisfied, they'll gladly switch you back to your old pharmacy. Fill, the smarter way to refill your prescriptions. Hey, everyone. Earwolf has a brand new show for you. It's available now, and I think you're really going to love this one. Jessica McKenna and Zach Reno are two of the funniest people out there, and they're also two of the most musical people. Together, they've made Off Book, the improvised musical podcast. Each episode, Jessica and Zach are joined by a hilarious improviser like Paul F. Tompkins or Mary Holland, and together, along with a live piano, they make a new musical on the spot. You might know Jessica from her characters on Comedy Bang Bang or her show Party Over Here on Fox, and you might have heard Zach on a recent Improv for Humans. So check it out. The show is pure, unadulterated musical joy in podcast form. Subscribe to Off Book from Earwolf in Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.
I wanted to jump over to some of the notable crew members.
Oh, sure.
Something that you wrote, but I wanted to speak about.
Go ahead.
Wally Pfister is the DP, and he filmed
Director of photography.
So he's the guy who controls the lights, basically. Filmed every one of Nolan's films up to Dark Knight Rises. He didn't do Interstellar and Dunkirk. He's also won several Academy Awards for cinematography, and it's an amazing DP off between him and Roger Deakins, who was, like, for the longest time, the Coen brothers, and also Sam Mendes.
Did he do Road to Perdition?
I didn't. Road to Perdition was Conrad Hall.
Oh, okay.
But he did the Bond one.
Skyfall?
Skyfall, yeah. So, and Wally Pfister just keeps stealing all of Roger Deakins' Academy Awards. And if you go over across the pond, where they have the BAFTAs, which is the equivalent of the Academy Awards, but for Britain, it slides the other way.
Where Deakins gets all the BAFTAs.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like
they're almost a prestige style.
Yeah. Yeah,
rivalry.
Battle.
It's exactly.
So we get another movie where it's two DPs.
And they also shoot similarly in that they use natural light. They don't.
Yeah, I thought that was neat. Like, most of the movie was filmed with natural light, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And also all handheld, which is, I guess, a thing we can get in later, but it's just Nolan wanted the eye lines to all be like the character's eye line or the audience's eye line. So, like, we're the audience watching the show on stage.
Right. Which I didn't. I watched featurettes between watching the movie twice, because I love homework. But but it was interesting on the second watch, like, really noticing how intentionally done that was. And also it seems like kind of a nod to magic, the devil's entertainment.
The devil's tricks.
The devil's bargain.
Well, I think it's mostly done to give you the feeling of being a fly on the wall and being witness to this, like, kind of play.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, a lot of documentary filmmaking will use handheld.
Yeah.
It also is very, like, energetic in that, like, it's because it's got these little nuances, like, bumps and such, because the handheld, it's an organic kind of thing.
Yeah.
A machine can't really do it.
They
and
point
it makes
out
it easier to, like, hide stuff from the audience,
right,
too.
Yeah, yeah, a little bit, yeah. So, I mean, that's Wally Pfister's well known.
Yeah, and he was.
Wanted to point him out as, like, you know, kind of one of the MVPs.
Yeah, he was nominated for an Oscar for this movie.
Yes.
And so was the
art direction.
Art direction with his Nathan Crowley and Julia Achipinti. Okay, I was going to mess that up. But Crowley did a lot of the set design and building, which he started doing apparently in Nolan's garage before they started making the sets and, like, the Universal backlot. And you can see one of the billboards in the background. It says, like, Sir Nathan Crowley's, like, miracle ointment or something. So he put his own name in there.
That's a pretty common thing to
yeah,
do.
Yeah, but it was just a neat thing that I didn't see it pointed out in any of the special features. I just happened to see it. I was like, look, there it is.
I will say that was the other thing about this movie that I was like, oh man, I'm being set up to get mad. Where there's a lot of steampunk imagery in this movie, and that is
there is.
Especially when we get into the Tesla stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Of, like, here's a vague machine we're not going to fully explain. Let's slap a couple gears on it, turn it into a backpack, let's throw in a leather vest, steampunk it up, done, production design, we're good. so that made me want to kick someone's ass. But other than that, the production design was
maybe
want
to push some geeks down a staircase.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I would kick any magician or steampunk adjacent person's ass. I just want to go on the record as saying that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're sliding into production, which is, like, at this point, that's perfect, because I wanted to talk about that a little bit too, which is because Nolan has a quote that I wanted to read, that it's like he's talking about exactly what you're talking about, like the setting in the movie. Mm-hmm. He says, the quote, "Victorian era is often mischaracterized as stuffy and repressive, when it was actually an incredibly exciting time in human development." He explains,
quote, you had a second industrial revolution, the birth of electricity, the birth of cinema, and the start of widespread international travel and science being turned onto its head by new theories. You have the beginning of mass advertising with billboards and posters. It was a period of great adventureness and with changes that are still being felt today, which I thought was actually kind of an interesting thing. It's very true. When we think of Victorian era, we think of like stuffy, you know, coats and shit like that. Like, we talk about how it wasn't that big of a change, when in reality, billboards and all that kind of stuff, and where everything's really like in your face, that was what London was starting to become. It was like the first major step towards modernist kind of cities, which I thought was fairly interesting. Although, putting gears on stuff, that may not be true. I think the idea, like, and the art direction team and Nolan were trying to make it just like make it loud, make it very like seem like there's just too much happening in the background.
Yeah, it communicates. I mean, the steampunk imagery, may it be struck down, does communicate that idea pretty effectively and fast. But also just like including the, I mean, I guess this is technically a nod to crushing Christopher Priest, but setting it in the exact time that he did it during like Tesla's like time in Colorado, which is like the weird, mysterious, what was he doing out there? Like the whole like field full of light bulbs. Like, yeah, like a lot of it is based on real stuff. And then later there was speculation about like, well, what was he actually doing?
Yeah, because there's a, apparently he built and patented several inventions that he then just buried and never.
Right.
Well, he also moved to America, if I remember. It was not necessarily one event, but a string of reasons. Like, everyone hated him in London and in Europe because he, like, famously created a resonant chamber that he, like, went around and, like, went to an abandoned apartment building and, like, looked at the resonance of each of the floors so you could find the perfect tone that would cause a feedback loop that would cause an earthquake.
Yeah, he built an earthquake machine.
I think he almost, and everyone was like, what the hell?
I think he did the same. He
built a lightning machine, too, like, in Colorado. He's, like, and I think that that's like vaguely the reason it's communicated that he leaves cult. Like, will we see David Bowie running away?
Edison comes and busts his factory up.
Right, which is like, man, let's see a fucking movie about that. That's so like the Edison Tesla.
That's going to be a Netflix or not even specialist series, like a fictional narrative of their fight.
I want to see that story like Sherlock with a lot of smarmy, like,
totally,
I'm going to get you. Like, I would love that shit so much.
Yeah, it would be fucking awesome.
I want to talk about more about production, and Tom, feel free to jump in at any time.
Sure.
Nolan only built one set for this film, which is crazy, considering all of the, like...
It was the streets, right?
No. He all shot that location shooting.
That was
under
the
stage
backlot
section, like where eventually the fish tank is and stuff like that, and it houses all the machinery. All that is, like, one biggish stage. It's also, like, where I believe when... they, like, brought all the stuff for when Michael Caine is like, what is all this stuff? That also
what
was kind of like,
what
is all this? That machine is not magic. And in order to make the larger illusions work, he kind of built that understage, you know, facade.
That makes sense.
In a already existing, I don't know, opera house kind of thing. And the reason is that he wanted to just dress various L.A., and Colorado and Victorian England sound stages or locations to stand in for that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's way different than most period pieces.
Right, yeah. He shot all in L.A. except for the Colorado stuff.
Yeah, which is insane.
Yeah.
And he did lots and stuff. So there's still, like, technically it's built, but he didn't, like, build it for the film. And it's because no one wanted to keep the quick pace of production. He knew he was going to have, like, if you look at the number of shots in this movie relative to most other movies, and this is true for Nolan in general, he has a high shot count relative to, like, you compare him to something like Spielberg, and he's like twice as many shots. And that's facilitated mainly by, like, how many jump cuts there are.
I was about to say there's little jump cuts, and
so
it's like, it goes between, like, five different timelines.
Yeah, some scenes are really only, like, six lines long, but he has, like, six shots, and, like, Spielberg would do that in one shot, you know? Like, it's just his shooting style. So he needed a quick pace, so he needed to shoot on location where he could just dress it instead of, like, well, for a day, no one does anything except the builders just build this facade so that we then can dress it the next day. So, and that's also why he chose handheld cameras, like a no-brainer, because you don't have to, like, the camera doesn't have to, like, be practiced. It can just, like, trust the, you know, improvised Wally Pfister and all the, you know, camera ops.
And with natural light, you don't have the setup.
Natural
time for
light,
the lights.
You kind of just Now, natural light doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't lights, right? What it means is they take the directionality of the light.
Like
they put someone close to a window, which is like a perfect way to light a scene. That's how a lot of the best guys do it, is they don't like have all these elaborate light schemes. Some of them do, but in the case of Pfister and like Deakins I mentioned earlier, one of the wisdoms that they talk about all the time is just like, what's the best way to light a scene like this? And I'm like, well, first thing is, why are they in the center of the room? You put them next to a window. Because that's the best, you got the best light in the world right up there in the space. And why chain
in the space?
That's like so, a Michael King, the best light comes the best up light. There in the sky.
Best light up there in the sky. Is up there in the space.
God is the greatest magician.
You look Michael up Kane there at God's is, anus. Yeah,
but anyway.
Shining brightly.
Often they'll just put like some filtration in there and then just supplement it with another light. And then that's, you know, bounce it around or whatever.
Yeah, they still do the
But it's very run and gun. You don't have to like set many lights. And, right. Like, make sure the direction works for the stage blocking. So in other words, everything was done to shoot fast.
It was finished entirely in 5 months, which I thought was amazing. Like they started.
Oh yeah, that's
I
right.
I was surprised at how short the shoot was. It was like January to April or something.
It was April to September, but
was it?
April's when they started shooting, and then mid-September is when like final mix, final cut was done.
Yeah, this seems like a movie that would take for. Forever.
Right?
But
like, it seems so complicated, and then it's like, nope, we're done.
I think they wrote it in they had plenty of time to think about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, they worked on it for a long time.
But I think I read the same thing as you were reading, but January to April was the amount of time, which was another quick thing, which was the turnaround from like location scouting and pre-production had been happening for a while. So I'm not talking about like the people making, like the art directors making things and stuff like that, but like the coming together sequence of movie making.
Yeah.
Usually that's more or less the equal amount of time as the production itself. And in this movie, it was really only like 3 months, which is just crazy.
Yeah.
It's shooting super fast and lean in many ways. I want to talk, kind of bleeds into post-production, but honestly, I just want to take we were talking about this earlier, Tom, about how in the next month, you're going to hear a lot more conversations about the scripting and about like our, you know, the second half of this podcast, which we kind of talk about more of the symbolism and stuff and like cool things you missed or, you know, goofs, because he is notorious, Christopher Nolan is notorious for like shutting down set. Like he does not allow a lot of crazy details about like the process of physical production.
He also doesn't talk about it.
And he doesn't talk about it. Yeah. It's just how he goes. Yeah. The Coen brothers are kind of the same way, and I'm sure we'll have a Coen brothers month.
Okay,
so we'll be talking more about, so in other words, this podcast will kind of adapt depending on what's interesting about the movie.
We're not going to be a magician.
To me, that says a lot of gentle mouth kisses are transpiring, yes. And it's like, but we don't talk about it.
No, gentle, but there's feeling behind it.
But leading with like his teeth, as we established earlier. So there's a connect, but then
leading with his chompers.
Yeah. Oh man, Jamie, you just derailed this fucking thing. It's lovely.
Yeah.
I want to talk about editing just one short thing that I thought was interesting. The editing crew includes, someone actually counted, I did not count this, 146 time jump cuts, next shot after, what time jump cuts means is the next shot after either the one before to one after flashes back or skips to another time period in the storyline. And some scenes have multiple, where it's like jumping from like an Ocean's 11, kind of like, oh, here we are at the heist. Oh, here we are planning the heist. Oh, we're back at the heist. That would be two time jump cuts. Mm-hmm. That number means that in terms of minute, this averages to almost one timeline jump per minute of the film.
Wow. Damn. It doesn't feel that way.
It doesn't feel confusing.
It's because you'll get a 3 minute sequence where there's no time jump cuts, but then you'll get a sequence of like 8 minutes where there's like 100 or whatever.
Well, I guess those diary scenes would do a lot too, because you sort of forget that those are happening at different times. That makes sense.
Yeah. Which makes Act 1, Act 2, Act 3 of this really tough.
Also, boys reading each other's diaries.
Oh.
Love it.
Oh yep. My
Love
gosh.
It. Kiss!
Just kiss, dudes.
The secret is Tesla. Read my diary.
I think this is a big...
I'll just leave this out.
This is a big thing in Nolan, though. Like, because he obviously did Memento 6 years earlier. Mm-hmm. He loves this idea of us, like, screwing with the temporality of a film. So that's actually a really good segue for another segment that we like to do in this, where we talk about, like, the observations that we got or that we took from the film based off what, like, the filmmaker's kind of dropping. We like to call this segment Hidden Bullshit.
Secret Thing.
So
this is a perfect movie.
I know.
Yeah, it's like loaded with hidden bullshit.
It's hidden bullshit.
every minute is more secret and more hidden.
Right.
And it's all bullshit things.
It's all secret bullshit and hidden things.
So we like to start off the bat by talking about like symbolism you may not have noticed. And here we look at like individual images in the film or ways in which it's constructed in a specific way that kind of lead your hand to like, oh, maybe it's about this.
Man, I wrote a treatise.
Yeah, you did. And I read it and it is good.
All right. Obviously, or maybe not obviously, the elderly Chinese magician that Angier and Borden go see at the beginning of the movie, who was a real magician, Chung Ling Su, they go to see it. So he sends him to him and says, see if you can figure out the fishbowl trick. And then Borden immediately is like, well, no, the trick is that he pretends to be frail all the time. So nobody guesses that he's fucking swole and can carry this fishbowl. That tells you right away, it symbolizes like his whole life, like his dual life that he has to live with his brother, and also his view of the art that they have. Borden's view of art is that you have to be willing to make huge sacrifices for your work. And in Borden's view, that means sacrificing having a public life because he and his brother can't have one or else their trick gets found out.
Right.
So he's like very closed off from the audience. And that's like the fundamental conflict of the film and ultimately why Angier is never able to guess how Borden does his trick, because Angier is the opposite, where he's like, he's a showman and all he cares about is being in the public eye. Like to him...
You should have seen their faces.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it seems cheesy, but that's like his
but
exact
that's his
motive.
Thing.
Yeah.
They both want to become like great. They want to be
but
known
they have
as great.
Different
ones.
Ideas of
they
greatness.
Have, they employ two different tactics,
Christian
which is why
Bale's a purist.
Right. Like he Christian Bale thinks the trick is the star, and Angier the performer is the star, and so that's why he wasn't able to figure out the quote unquote Chinese magician's trick, and he's never able to figure out or accept how simple Borden's trick is. Mm-hmm. He's never able to separate his ego from his art.
Most notably when Michael Caine's like, it's the only way it's done.
You know?
Like he's like,
that's the only way I know
how to do it. And he's like, no, it's too simple. He's too good of a magician for that.
So that's why he picks a duplication machine that forces him to commit murder each night.
Mm-hmm. First of all, the sexiest mass grave ever. Just a bunch of dead Hugh
bunch
Jackman.
Of floating Hugh Jacks.
What do they do?
Rot.
Where do they bury them? Where do they go?
Well, at the end of the movie, the warehouse burns down, so the cops, like the Victorian cops, are going to stumble upon 100 skeletons
in
this burned
down building. Are
we assuming
that all
building.
The Hugh Jackmans are just kept in buildings?
I thought he threw them in a furnace.
Is there... Mm-mm. Oh,
At the end, he...
It's a bunch of soggy
they're
hues.
They're all just in... Yeah, they're soggy hues. A bunch of damp hues.
Damp hues,
at
baby.
The end, they're all just... He has Sopping them all hues. Lined up in the bottom of the theater, and then Christian Bale shoots him, and Hugh Jackman kicks his lantern over, and the theater catches fire. So the cops are going to find 101 Hugh Jackman
Dalmatians.
Skeletons.
Dalmatians!
But yeah, so like that scene in the beginning, it like symbolizes the conflict of the movie, the duality of the two characters. And then something I wanted to point out interestingly is the Chinese magician Chung Ling Su was a real person who was actually a white American man in disguise.
Yeah, real Mickey Rooney.
Yeah. But he lived as this Chinese dude for like 19 years. Like he never let on that he wasn't who he pretended he was to be, and then he was killed on stage by a bullet catch. And that's, he spoke, when he got shot, he was like, oh no, something's wrong. Pull the curtain down. And that's like literally the first time audiences had any clue he wasn't actually a Chinese man. Because he said that in perfect English because he just got shot. He was like, oh shit.
Honestly, poor commitment.
Yeah.
Zero out of 10.
Game of his commitment. And then related to that, the first scene where you see Rebecca Hall when she goes to the magic show where Christian Bale is.
Right.
And the little boy sees the bird trick, and then he immediately starts crying. He's like, but what about his brother?
That's a fun second viewing scene.
Right, because like you see Christian Bale's face, he's like, smart kid. Like,
fair point.
Yeah, like he figured out his trick, and also the twist in the movie is what
perfect
about...
sentence. Damn it.
And they tell you that right there.
Yeah, that was a fun
It's a
scene.
Very
like,
smart scene.
Ah, you trickster.
And then
you Nolan.
Yeah, and then in the very, you know, when Borden goes in the back and he takes the bird out and he says, you're the lucky one today, that's foreshadowing Angier's version of the trick. Because Angier at the end says that he never knew which one he was going to be. If he was going to be the one that died or if he was going to be the one that got to be the prestige, you know, be the guy that didn't get killed.
And it's especially interesting because, like, the bird just represents them, but it's always specifically a cage.
Birds in cages, because they're all trapped. All the characters are trapped.
Right.
In cages
Very
of their own design.
Subtle metaphor.
Yeah.
Either
Very
a water
subtle.
Tank or this accepted kind of joint, we're going to only live one life. Their cage is each other.
Right.
In the case of Christian Bale's.
And the water tank
Borden's.
also represents that, and it also represents the tragedy. It also is kind of like a foreshadowing, because, you know, they're... their devotion to their dummy magic.
I mean, obsession, really.
Their obsession is what kills them all. And it's the symbol of the obsession because that's where his wife drowned.
Right.
And then...
I have something to say about that.
Sure.
And this is kind of because of the podcast I do, which is about the role of women in movies,
sure.
I'm sort of super attuned to noticing when female characters are being used by the plot to, you know, further flesh out a male character. And Christopher Nolan, I mean, historically, without question, does this constantly. Like, it's egregious. It's like, have you ever met a woman? Like, what are you doing?
I'm not sure he's met a human being.
I don't know. Like,
he's particularly...
Can someone introduce Christopher Nolan to a woman? Because he doesn't know how to write female characters. Jonathan Nolan's a fucking freak, too. He hasn't met a woman, I don't think.
Oh, jeez, he did Westworld, too.
And this is the best Christopher Nolan does to date of the release of this movie. I think of all the movies of his I've seen, Interstellar, he does the best, and even then he doesn't do great. But this movie is just like all the female characters are used, murdered, commit suicide to flesh out this idea of obsession. They're casualties of obsession, which exactly. And at times are abused and killed to fuel this rivalry. So it starts with Hugh Jackman's wife, who seems to be smart and, like, I would argue is the closest to a female magician that we see because she's, you know, she's an integral part of the show.
She knows the trick. She has her own input.
Right. She's like, I can escape this knot, all this stuff. So she has a little bit of agency. And the second we see her start to demonstrate agency, she is killed.
Immediately dead.
And that is the last example of female agency we see in the entire fucking movie.
Right.
Where it's like Rebecca Hall's character. And I know that this is, you know, especially in the second viewing, I'm like, okay, I understand why this scene is written this way. But I want to fucking strangle the Christopher's priest and Nolan, the Kiss and Chris's. I want to kill him. Mm-hmm. Because there's that scene where he's like, I love you so much. And she's like, not today. Maybe you just love magic more than me today. I was like, fuck you. Like, don't write that. And I understand, you know, once you know that there's two Christian Bales, but that's just lazy and stupid. And
but also Hall's character is entirely reactionary. If you look at it from a plot standpoint, things are happening to her. So yeah, it's like, yeah, of course that character would just be reacting in the moment to that or that. And it's like, yeah, because the setup is that she doesn't have any agency from the get-go. The moment she's like, I would like to be in a relationship with you and thinks it's one thing, she's already being lied to. And so she's in an impossible situation.
I'm so on her side, especially at the beginning, because I'm like, don't date a magician, Rebecca. I've been you. You don't need to do this.
Oh, that quote-unquote, like, cute thing that they do where he's like, you think this can keep me out? And she's like, okay. And then walks inside and his fucking brother's in there.
And he's like, hi.
And then she laughs. I'm like, no.
She's like, well, I guess you're staying for tea. I was like, what the fuck? This is great. And then Scarlett Johansson's character gets off the luckiest of all the female characters because she survives.
She runs.
She is not, you know, killed. But even then, it's like her motivation is sort of confusing throughout.
She's an unclear
very
character.
Unclear. Yeah,
she's kind of just thrown into into like the rivals' lives to further the plot, and it's not clear what she wants. And the closest I could come to identifying what she wants is a normal domestic home life with a nice magician.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, it pisses me off whenever, especially Christopher Nolan, because he never doesn't do it, except in his new movie, Boy City.
Boy City.
Where he's like, no more girls, just kissing Chris's. Yeah.
None more women's.
Harry Styles kissing on other boys or whatever the fuck that movie is about. It's just frustrating to see every female character and great actress is just like, wasted.
Right, like Rebecca Hall's performance is really good, but like the character is
doesn't have much to. I think that's a really interesting point about how all of his movies are like women being victims to specifically the obsession. Another thing that I thought that was interesting though about a particular scene, just getting back to your point about how it's all crafted for obsession, the onstage double of Angier. He announces, he's like, I've played Faust and Caesar in the past.
Yeah.
Both famously portrayed on stage as men who were destroyed by their own ambition.
Yeah, that's true.
Smart.
Yeah, so I thought that was like, oh, Yeah, and Jeerwol, too.
I did love Hugh Jackman as Root.
Oh, he was great. He was great.
Yeah. I love the moment that he's, like, super hammered, but then he totally
And then
pulls
he, like, becomes
off,
an actor.
And they're like, oh, shit.
Well, okay.
You're like, I feel like he does that in real life sometimes, maybe.
Oh, yeah. No, this is how this guy works.
That's like, what Hugh Jackman did before he hosted the Oscars.
He's super like, theatrical, too. Like, he's in musicals. He does theater, you know, like, he's...
I love Hugh Jackman.
Like, he's not just Wolverine. He's, like, this big, larger-than-life kind of attitude. And he doesn't get it showcased in movies that often.
We were saying before, he better be a good person.
I hope so. Yeah. If we find out, if he does a Mel Gibson on us, it's going to be real tragic.
Devastating.
I think anyone does a Mel Gibson on anything, it's tragic.
That's never a good
it doesn't matter if it's Hugh Jackman or anyone.
I had something to say about the all the drowned Angier clones as it represents, you know, because it's all obsession, which is one of the main points of the film.
He's and killing how, parts of himself.
And how he specifically, I mean, they both kind of do, but Angier really suffers from it the worst, where he completely loses his way. He loses himself to his obsession. Like, he has a line where Scarlett Johansson says to him, none of this is going to bring your wife back. He's like, I don't care about my wife. I care about the secret. Mm-hmm. And then he catches himself. He's like, oh, shit. But, like, he still keeps going in this way. So, in a way, like, the dozens of drowned Angier clones represent that, because by the end of the movie, we have no idea if he's even the original Angier anymore.
Right.
He probably isn't.
Chances are
he's
not,
right? Because, like, when we see the teleportation machine work, the original copy is the one in the machine, and that's the one that gets dropped into the tank.
I almost assumed that, I mean, you know, they do the flashback to one of the Hugh Jackmans is shot. I the first time I saw it, I assumed that was the original Hugh Jackman, but maybe it wasn't. I don't know.
No, because the original one steps into the machine, and then nothing happens, and he sees his clone across the room, and then he grabs a gun and shoots him. So that's probably
so that
the original.
No,
it's not clear.
No, it's clear. It's remember, there's that one time he's like, I'm not sure if I'm going to be the man in the water tank
he
or not.
He says that, yeah.
So that's a way of him saying he does not know.
He doesn't know because
it's
he's
a complete
a clone
duplication.
Each time.
Yeah. So he just wakes up.
With all the memories, yeah.
Right. But as far as the guy who's always out of the water tank, his continual memory is that
he doesn't really know.
Whomever you're talking to at that time, if they're not in a water tank, thinks that they're the most winningest version of Hugh Jackman.
But he'll never know, and we don't know. So, like, for all intents and he's killed himself so many times.
Right.
For all intents and purposes, he doesn't exist anymore. And it's because he just sank completely into this obsession. And related to what you mentioned earlier, Jamie, about why does he drown himself, it could be seen as penance. Because we do have that scene where he, after his wife drowns, he is sticking his face into a sink full of water to, like, experience what she experienced.
Right.
So it could be some part of him trying to pay penance.
I could see that being part of it. Yeah, I don't know, but he lost his way so much. Like, the point
but
where he's like...
It's true, yeah.
The point where he's like, fuck my dead wife. You're just like, oh.
Yes, well, we don't... Yeah, that's the argument against it.
It's been,
like,
confused. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I could still see it be... I mean, I don't think he actually meant... Fuck my dead wife. Like,
no, but
he was just taken up by, like, this is the goal right now.
He's so consumed
and
by it.
But
yeah.
I could totally see, and it's totally intentional by the writers, that the reason it's a water tank is because it's serving some kind of purpose to relive the suffering that caused him down this path. So it's like PTSD.
He references
water.
That too, like the first time he does it, where he's like, it killed. I mean, he doesn't say it was his wife.
He says, the woman who taught me this trick died performing it. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I guess if you say it was your wife, that kind of brings the mood down a little
right.
bit.
Right. He
You're
doesn't
like,
want
to. My wife died doing this, anyways.
Anyway, I'm all inside.
Yikes.
Turn the music up.
Hopefully, Christian Bale isn't here in a goatee.
Yeah.
He always is.
A fake beard conflict.
Oh, my favorite shot in the movie is Christian Bale cutting off Christian Bale's fingers.
Yeah.
That's the greatest, that's a solid one. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's his penance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a literal cage. It's just cutting off a part of yourself to sacrifice for the saint.
Right.
The whole.
Yeah. And the whole movie is the theme of the movie is obsession and also duality. But, like, I think they wind up portraying Hugh Jackman and Angier as being more villainous, but neither character is really evil.
Mm.
Their rivalry is so destructive and it so consumes them that it kills them essentially, because it kills one of Christian Bale's twins, and it also kills Angier, and then also it ruins everyone around them.
I kind of like Christian Bale less. I know he wins at the end, but once Rebecca Hall killed herself,
right?
Because Christian Bale couldn't just be
he was obsessed with not only Angier, the rivalry, but more so with his trick. Like, he was so obsessed with preserving his trick that he couldn't.
And that's such a
throw
huge,
her a fucking bone.
That's such a huge casualty. Yeah, like she could have handled that.
I think,
but like. I don't know. So I ended up liking him less by the end, because, like, Hugh Jackman didn't kill his wife, and I think Christian Bale kind of
accidentally, maybe, accidentally, but that's like another, that's like another like clue for us where he's like, I don't remember. And it's because he probably doesn't. It's probably because his brother tied the knot and then didn't tell him what he did. So he's like, I can't tell you what knot it was because I don't know.
So something I always thought that was really interesting about this movie is that if you look at the narrative itself, if you like try to take the time jumps out of it and say like what really happened and dissect it in that way, the film itself is structured like a magic trick. It's got the pledge. We see Borden in jail and he promises that he's going to get out. The turn, the crazy events of the second act, and how the duel creates suffering for both protagonists by just reading the other's journals and trying to guess what
happening. Right, and the surprise when we learn that Andrew's still alive.
Yeah, and the prestige as Borden is restored, kind of, and we see how both tricks are done. So even though it's all messed up in the film, that's kind of Christopher Nolan's bag for any movie that at least he does time jumps. Or he has like a game like an Inception where there's like an unfolding of reality. Because when he folds it back to you, usually at the, you know, in the middle to end of the third act for us.
He socks it back.
Yeah.
He socks it to you.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, he does that because he's going to be like, so all the things that I weaved, I'm going to unweave for you so you can see it. I keep coming back to Ocean's 11 because it's the fundamental trick that comes from that movie, which is that I'm going to weave the telling you of how things are going to go and the reality of how things actually went at the same time to show what worked, what didn't, so that you kind of have this cool effect editorially when you watch the movie of like, oh, it's kind of magic how it are revealed, but it also allows you to hide some of the plot holes, some of the things that you're not supposed to think about because it might damage the film. Like a lot of things that people talked about after they got like I remember when I watched it with a group of friends, everyone really liked it, and then like a few days later we all started talking about like, don't you think it's kind of stupid that both Christian Bales decided this is the thing we should do with our life rather than like spend our lives together? No, that isn't a plot.
Also, one of the brothers is clearly not as into magic.
It's just, it's just, like,
and it's the one who hooks up with Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah, the angry one.
And that's not a plot hole, but that is a thing where you stop and you go,
It's a logic leap.
That's not, that's kind of dumb. I mean, not in like a sci-fi way where it's like, well, there's just like super magic. You can fly in hyperspace. Well, yeah, you just go, okay.
There's a different, I mean, there's a different version of this movie where you know, it's like where you could learn the dynamic between the two Christian Bales. Because that's super interesting. Because clearly one of them is less into it. And I would assume if that goes on long enough, maybe at some point he'd be like, I'm sorry, I want to marry Scarlett Johansson. She's, listen, one must. And we're quitting magic.
One must.
We're learning a trade. We're blacksmiths now, whatever.
I'm going to go pack fish at the dock so I can marry Scarlett Johansson.
Like a fair trade.
I just fucking love magic.
But yeah, it's, and I think he points it out in one of the special features Nolan does is that both the magic trick and the movie that he's making, and also movies in general, it's about manipulating the narrative, manipulating the audience perception.
Memento, Inception,
and tricking them, basically. And then you're showing them that you've tricked them at the end. And they're like, oh, and then
everyone claps for you because they go like, oh, it was a thing that I didn't expect. And it feels like a twist, you know, like, but it wasn't quite a twist. It was just unexpected.
Right.
But then you realize when you start actually, usually when you take out the device, like either
if you
the time jump,
straight.
If you just tell it straight of act one, act two, act three with a normal structure of like temporality and all that stuff, you go like, these people are acting kind of weird.
Right. Yeah.
They're not real humans. So that's what I just want to get at is that he's exceptionally good at this trick. And that's why he's one of the better directors alive today is because he's so good at just, when it comes down to it, he's just like, no, movies are just entertainment. And so I can't dock the guy for points of being not able to write a human well. I mean, that's true. Yeah. But I'm also like,
he doesn't know what the humans do.
That's not what makes him,
he's not a Sidney Lumet. He's not a Kubrick. He's not a, you know, like.
He should maybe try a little harder though.
He can try a little harder. You're not wrong.
He should make a friend who can maybe help. That's not his brother.
I just wanted to touch real briefly on the duality that's in the movie. Because that's another main theme of the movie. And the duality is represented in the two characters. You know, like, Borden's low class, Andrew's high class. Like, Borden's like an artiste. Andrew's a showman, kind of uses the art as a tool.
Yeah.
Borden's English, Andrew's American. It's just, and he's also like, Borden's kind of like dark and angry, and Hugh Jackman's like bright and upright, which is also like weird because it puts the two on their head later. And then the duality is echoed by the inclusion of Tesla and Edison. Because Tesla's basically Borden. Because Tesla famously was all about the work. He was kind of closed off from people. He didn't like...
Bad businessman.
Bad businessman.
Could not guard those patents to save his damn life.
No, he was bad at understanding the politics of what he was doing, but he was
a pure genius.
Pure genius, right. Amazing at what he did, and he was all about the science. He was all about the thing. And then, of course, Edison is much more Angier, who's a big bombastic showman. He's like, I'm the face of all this. And also the plot, Edison famously stole inventions from people, and the plot's literally Angier stealing another man's trick.
Right, right. So, like Edison and Marconi just fucked Tesla.
Oh, yeah.
And then he went cuckoo bananas because who can blame him?
And that's ironic, right?
Right, yeah, because Angier goes to Tesla to help him steal another man's thing.
It should
and
be
Tesla,
Edison, but...
And Tesla's not super receptive to him at first.
Right.
Because he's like, you seem like a big faker. But then eventually he's like,
I need
Are
money.
You hungry?
I need
You hungry? Want to hang?
Also, this is neither here nor there, but Bowie's heterochromia. Heterochromia kind of represents that duality.
Right.
Which is color eyes.
Heterochromia, two color eyes.
I
thought there was Nolan includes a nice touch here with the Tesla Edison's Borden Angier thing. When Tesla's machines are exhibited at the that big royal hall,
mm-hmm.
A man in the audience protests and says, Tesla, this electric current is unstable. Like he's totally rallying, calling fire in a crowded theater. Later in the movie, that same man appears in Colorado Springs as one of Thomas Edison's associates.
It's real subtle, but
and that proves that magicians are not the only ones who hide people within their rivals' audiences.
Big beards, yeah.
Right.
It's when Hugh Jackman's walking in the hotel and he very briefly, they hang on this guy and there's like a flash of recognition in Hugh Jackman. It's very subtle, but that's him recognizing that guy from the hall.
Yeah, saying
earlier.
Like, oh shit, like this is an artifact of people who are in rivalries, not people who are like, you know, just in competition. This is obsession. This is
I like Tesla's sign off too, or where like paraphrase, but he's basically like, well, people don't like new and cool stuff in science. Maybe they'll like it in your little goofy magic show. Yeah. Bye.
Maybe they'll like it with your fucking Tinker Toys and shit.
Yeah.
Peace.
Like condescending and rightfully so.
Right. Now that we've talked about, you know, all that cool stuff, we're gonna segue to a segment that talks about the scenes we'd like to have seen in the movie that either would have enhanced it. Maybe not enhanced it. Maybe it should have been hilarious.
Yeah.
In a segment we like to call bonus scenes that should have existed. I want to see Hugh Jackman and Michael Caine burying that guy alive, because that would have taken like an afternoon.
So long.
Like out in the open, just digging a hole, pushing that guy in the ground.
Yeah, and it doesn't end there. It's not like the burying happens and then like
wait for
just like, well, there's no one's ever gonna find me this mass grave.
I want to see two women talk to each other. It's never gonna happen in a Christopher Nolan movie.
It's super dark. It's true though.
It's never. They can be in the same scene, but then Scarlett Johansson, get out of there. They're too close to passing the Bechdel test.
But, yeah.
I also want to see the pile of Hughes. I want to see
Hughes?
A pile of Hughes. Mm-hmm. Or show me my pile of Hughes.
Mine's kind of similar to that, but it's like the sleeper of that. Because like, okay, so the pile of Hughes was every time he did it, he got a new clone that he had to bury. So
new Hugh.
Let's say there's 100, you know, like whatever.
New day, new Hugh.
That's a lot, like or 50 to 100.
I picked 100 because he said he was going to do 100 performances.
Right, right.
Yeah, we don't know how far he got.
But
pile of Hughes.
Remember that
the old stack
in order,
of Hughes.
It's been set as precedent that in order for Tesla to do this, he tries it on hats and cats. So I want to see the hundreds of cat that Tesla makes. So Circus. Who owns all these cats, by the
right.
way?
Right, yeah, they're all cats.
Cats
now.
Like, I just want to have him go to the supermarket and buy, like, thousands of cans of cat food. And she's like, I fucking hate you, Tesla. I hate you so much.
I want to see more, extended scene of, like, Bowie and Circus just fucking hanging out.
Right?
Like, totally improvised scene between the two of them. What the fuck would they talk
what
about?
Are those, yeah, what do those two dudes talk about all day? Like, their relationship's fascinating.
Yeah, what's going on? Oh, God, I love how much Andy Circus is like, whatever happens to this animal is on you. And David Bowie's like, what? Whatever.
It does not respond. He's just like, turn on.
But at the same time, like,
there's
genuine, like, love in his voice when Circus is talking to Jackman about, like, he's a genius. He's a recluse.
Yeah.
You don't understand.
And they're BFFs, man. They got two halves of that locket.
Yeah. Okay, and then let's just take it to the gentle mouth kiss between Bowie and Circus.
Kisses. Sir Kiss.
More like Sir
Kiss.
Sir Smooch.
We've talked about the movie. We've talked about observations. Is there any weird non-intuitive arguments about this movie? We call the segment, Let's Overthink It.
The only one I had is just one that we brought up early in the podcast, but like, what if, you know, Bale never had a twin and it was just, you know, he did have Bowie make him that machine. He used it one time to make himself a copy.
That's what I originally thought. Because the use of the word twins, I'm like, oh, like they could be using the word twins like they would use clones or whatever. But
I mean, the timeline doesn't work for it. But
right, yeah.
Right.
But that was like my first thought. And then, if you think about it for 2 seconds, it kind of falls apart.
Yeah, mine's kind of similar because the machine is a big offer. And I think that the second that this is in the world, Tesla should have a little bit more complex thoughts about this because, yes, he was commissioned. Yes, he was paid. So he has to give a machine to him. But Tesla's the kind of guy, at least historically, that is more about the science than the application of the science. Like, the application of science is good and all, but, like, it's more about the journey there. It's about figuring the thing out. So if he finds out this magical teleportation / duplicator thing, he's going to figure out a way to make this a little different from just, like, its function is to teleport a man. You know, in the same way that when, you know, physicists were designing an A-bomb, they only later realized, oh, you know what, nuclear power is also a good idea,
creates
too.
A tremendous amount of energy. Yeah,
so, like, there's going to be something where Tesla in the next year or two is going to totally change everything in the world with this replicator system.
Right.
And all of a sudden we're Star Trek, you know? So, like, to me, the most interesting story is about Tesla and his ability to now harness physics in a unique way, not the silly magic man.
The silly magic war.
I think it's just so funny that they're just like, yeah, this is a story about Tesla's in it, but he's palling around with magicians. He's just goofing off. The reason I think I jumped to thinking that Borden had used Tesla's machine is because, like you were saying, Tom, like there's like they are the match. Like that is the partnership that makes way more sense of that they would have met and like worked together and all that. And I was just surprised that we don't see them together because they have the same view in their respective fields. Like they're purists and they're all about
that would explain, that would cover that logic leap. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause they'd be like, oh, dude, titans of industry. Yes.
Yep. Right.
But I think
I guess
that
there wasn't time.
Either of them would kind of hurt the film for me because it's like, hey, Henry Ford, let's make a movie about you. But instead of, we're going to make two
Henry
guys,
Ford.
Henry Ford, we're going to take two.
Let me ask you a question. Can we make the Jews look real bad?
Yeah.
In this movie?
Well, that's also
sure,
true.
Henry Ford.
No, but like, cause he like develops this combustion engine thing. And then they're like, let's tell that movie, but like two guys who like love motorcycles and just have them race a bunch of times.
Two hog boys.
Yeah, two hog boys.
Two dueling Evel Knievels.
Yeah, and it's just like, no, that's not
kissing
the movie.
Kissing and doing sick jumps.
I want to see the version of this movie where instead of the double being Fallon, the double is Leno.
Coming back to that gold mine.
We're going to do magic.
Boom, 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 boom. Yeah. Whatever, Jay Leno was.
He also rides motorcycles.
Keynote
so.
Speaker at my college graduation.
Oh, dope!
Yeah, it was. He was what a nightmare.
What a nightmare.
Jay's 12 Hollywood tips. That was his speech.
Oh, great!
Jesus, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh man.
Oh man. That's
he
like
did a listicle.
Were they helpful?
No.
Not at all. Okay. Solid. Thanks, Jay.
Of course not.
All right. So we talked about how the movie was made and how some things were problematic, possibly, definitely in the case of this movie. Considering everything we talked about, you know, with the themes and all stuff that was problematic and stuff that wasn't, we were trying to figure out whether or not this movie should go into the gold record that we send into space. So the big question is, that we like to end every episode is do we show this to aliens?
I'm going to be first and say no.
No,
because,
why?
Because it's about magic, and I think that we want to keep the... And it debunks magic a little bit. I mean, it has the David Bowie thing, but it's like all these magicians that we say we have. I would like to see if the aliens are like convinced by our parlor tricks and slide.
Right, like the slide, the thumb slide.
Because if they realize, no, it's just like thumbs, then they're going to be like, well, fuck these guys. They don't have magic. And I want them to think, if it's at all possible, that we might have magic.
Just to keep the upper hand.
Just keep the upper hand.
And they're not coming anymore.
I mean, they're coming for us.
Well, Abhishek, Jamie, what do you think?
I'm going to say, well, I'm sort of on the fence with, keep in mind what you just said, I don't want the aliens to see magic and be like, hey, let's continue this. I would rather not introduce them to magic if they've never heard of it. This is a great stopping point for magic and magicians. However, if they do like magic, this is a great movie to show them magic isn't real. We should probably knock down the magic castle. So I could see it going both.
You want to see Independence Day, but it starts with the magic castle instead of like the White House.
Intensely personal. please never be a head of state.
This is just.
My first and only action would be we're gonna knock down everyone. I mean, we're gonna evacuate it.
Sure.
And we're going to send all the magicians to trade school. And they're going to get a degree, and they're going to we're going to teach them how to talk to women. It's going to be great. But we are going to knock down the magic castle, and that is step one step and step one. Last.
Step last.
And then all I resign.
All just in terms of you scrubbing magicians from the earth.
This is my Christian Bale long con. It's There's a good another one of me.
Oh, man.
There's a movie in this.
No. I'm going to say yes.
Okay.
Because I realize every answer I've given so far on this show is in terms of the impending alien war.
Right.
I just think this is a good movie.
It is.
It's well made. It looks good. It's got strong themes that are well communicated.
I like that you just want the aliens to see a good flick.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, it's very honest. Maybe that will save us from the war.
It might.
Yeah.
Or they'll see it and not understand what it is and be terrified by magic and then blow us up immediately.
We don't understand complex narrative.
Yeah.
That's so
we don't understand magic, but we know what Satan is. Blow you up.
That's super cute of you, I must say. Well,
just
it sounds
have fun.
It sounds like the yeses have it. So we're done here. We want to talk a little bit of how you can talk to us. Check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Cracked Movie Pod. Please hit us up with your thoughts, people. We've been Abe, Tom, and Jamie. Jamie, where can we find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at HamburgerPhone because I saw Juno in 2007 in high school. You can also find my podcast, The Bechdel Cast, at Bechdel Cast, and we talk about the role of women in movies every week.
Fantastic.
Cool. And this, to be clear, this show. Movie super doesn't pass.
Oh, super doesn't pass.
There is only one scene with two women in it.
Yeah,
there you go.
And it does not pass.
Well, check out that podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Make sure it's awesome.
It's a real fun one.
It's a real fun one.
No, it is. I listened to the Transformers one.
It's an important one.
Oh,
that's great.
It's really good, yeah.
Well, we've been honored that you've joined us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Next week, we're going to be talking about another Nolan film, Inception.
Yep.
Hey, comment buddies, we're open to films and directors you think we should talk about, so let us know. I'm not joking. We'll read it.
Yeah,
we'll
definitely.
That's it. So watch on, movie people.
This is Jess McKenna.
And I'm Zach Reno.
And we're the hosts of a new podcast right here at Earwolf called Off Book,
the improvised musical podcast.
It's a podcast, but it's also an improvised musical where we get a guest and we talk to them, and then Scott Passarella starts playing, and then we black out for a second. When we come to, we've created a brand new musical.
Yeah. People are saying it's better than the Beatles.
You can say that, too. If you listen to our first episode with Paul F. Tompkins or our second episode with Mary Holland, we got some great guests lined up. So, guys, rate, review, and you gotta subscribe on that Apple Podcast, baby.
Or wherever you listen to your podcast. We'd like it so much. Just so much.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.